Good morning, brothers and sisters and young people. I want to thank the Ecclesia at Boston for sponsoring and working on this gathering. It's been a real pleasure being here this weekend, until now, of course. I want to acknowledge from the very beginning that my remarks this morning will not have been in any way diluted or simplified, or, as young people say, dumbed down, because of the inclusion of young people in our audience. In fact, when discussing my assignment with the brother, he remarked that I had the kids' class. Well, everything I have to say this morning is of paramount importance, whether you are a kid of 13 or whether you are a kid of 70 plus. I understand that this period is for those aged 13 and above. In an ironic way, this is very appropriate considering our subject this morning. We're studying lessons from Israel, which can be applied to ourselves. You see, the Jews consider 13 to be the age when a young person reaches the age of responsibility. As many of you know, when a Jewish youth obtains to his or her 13th birthday, the occasion is noted by a celebration which for a boy is called a bar mitzvah and for a girl a bat or a bas mitzvah. In Hebrew then, a boy becomes a son of the commandment. A girl becomes a daughter of the commandment. Being educated in the law and the tradition of the Jews, these young people are deemed to be old enough to be responsible for their own actions. Like many so-called Christian observances, like Christ Mass and Easter, the Bar or Bat Mitzvah is not based upon scriptures. In fact, the Jews began this observation sometime during the 19th century. Incidentally, one very important thing that every Jewish child was taught concerning his or her responsibility as being a son or a daughter of the commandment was that he or she should strive to do everything to his or her very best before God. For example, it did not matter if one was poor or rich, but when one went to the synagogue on Shabbat, or as we know it, the Sabbath, one wore one's very best clothes. It didn't matter whether one's attire was from Macy's or from a Goodwill thrift store. As long as it was the best, as long as it was the best that one owned. This principle of doing one's best before God is worthy of emulation, and we will return to this thought later. The basis for a celebration of a bar or bat mitzvah was derived from the parents' joy that they were no longer responsible for the acts of their children. At 13, the children became responsible before God and man for their own actions. And so the parents celebrated their freedom from their child's actions. Just as Christ Mass and Easter today have more to do with materialism, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny than anything regarding true religious principles, likewise today, the Jewish celebration of bar and bat mitzvahs have more to do with throwing a party than with a heartfelt conscience toward God. But even worse, the parents and the children, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, a people whose ancestors were entrusted with the oracles of God, are without truth and without faith in the true God of Israel, Yahweh Elohim. Secular Jews, those that do not believe in religion at all, have absolutely no faith. And religious Jews believe all kinds of nonsense, from the immortality of the soul to some even believing in reincarnation. What can be said about the most pious of the religious Jews today was said by Paul regarding his people in his day, "For I bear them record that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge." How the Jews reached this point where we find them today, and indeed where our Lord found them at his first appearance, is worthy of our utmost consideration, young and old. You have probably heard that those who fail to learn from the mistakes of history are doomed to repeat it. History bears witness to the truth of this statement. The apostasy of the Israelites was repeated by the Gentile ecclesias in Paul's day and afterwards. Paul testified that the mystery of iniquity was already at work in his day. And the legacy of that iniquity is the Roman Catholic system with her Protestant harlot daughters who, like the Jews, promulgate and believe just about every conceivable kind of nonsense under the sun. But the scary things, brothers and sisters and young people, is that after the revival of the truth in the 19th century by Brethren Thomas and Roberts, those who call themselves Christadelphians have likewise invited, entertained, cultivated, and nourished error and truth-nullifying doctrines that have placed the Christadelphian community at large in dire straits. And the horror of the situation of the majority of Christadelphians today, and I'm speaking about Christadelphia at large, is that they do not recognize the peril therein. Fortunately, in our community, we still have sanctuary from the tempest of error surrounding us. Hence the necessity of understanding how Israel failed so that we, too, do not repeat their mistakes. It would be difficult to examine all the incidents in the history of the nation of Israel which provide evidence of their failures before Yahweh and were the basis for his judgments upon them. But we will provide a brief overview of their history to establish major mistakes they made, which we should not repeat. Israel's history as a nation begins in the book of Exodus. Before the time of the Exodus account, Israel was a man, Jacob, and consisted of his family. But his family grew into a nation in a relative short time, and their size and presence alarmed their Egyptian host. The Egyptians, not given regard to the character and loyalty of Joseph, became Israel's captors rather than continuing to be their benefactors. As captives, the nation suffered under the burdens placed upon them. As has been the case from then even until modern times, the Egyptians adopted what was to be a program of genocide, to deal with what was euphemistically called in the 1930s by the Germans the Jewish problem. As we know, Moses was saved from this evil program to extinguish the growth of the Hebrews in Egypt. There is no doubt that some of this great nation in bondage worshiped and kept faith in the God of their fathers. We are told, for example, that the Israelite midwives feared God and did not as the king of Egypt had commanded them. But undoubtedly, there were also many who had become jaded by their sojourning in Egypt and who did not have faith in the God of their fathers. Collectively, whether in faith or not, the nation sighed and cried by reason of their bondage, and their cry came up to God. We are told in the last verse of the second chapter of Exodus that God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. We'd like to focus our attention on this last verse in Exodus 2 before we comment further about the history of Israel's failures. In this verse, the word respect is a less preferable translation of the Hebrew word yada, Y-A-D-A. Those of you who have Oxford editions of the Bible will note that the alternative rendering given in the center column reference is the word new, thereby suggesting that the last phrase be rendered, and God knew them. It should be apparent that the nation had at this juncture done nothing worthy of the respect of deity. So the alternative rendering that God knew them would certainly appear to be better. But in what sense did the omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent creator of the universe know them? To answer this question, it would be helpful to examine the usage of the Hebrew word yada in other verses. This word means to acknowledge, to be aware, to discern, to consider, to feel, to have understanding, to perceive, and to have knowledge. There are other definitions too, but these are perhaps the most representative of the word and the most helpful to our understanding this morning. We find the word yada early in Genesis. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die, for God doth know, yada, that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as God, knowing, yada, good and evil. In this passage we find the word in two instances, know and knowing. In the first verse of the next chapter, we read that Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived. Here yada is translated as knew and indicates the most intimate and complete relationship between a husband and wife. In the first chapter of Exodus, we are told that there was a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Here knew, again, is yada. And we understand from this that he had no comprehension at all about Joseph. He was clueless about the significance of Joseph. Further on in Exodus, we read in the sixth chapter, the third verse, deity speaks, by my name Yahweh was I not known. Known Yahweh. Here we find yada. Here we find yada, which can be rendered to be known in the negative. In these examples, we should begin to see that the word yada has reference to a deep understanding. It means more than just to be aware of. A few more examples should convince any doubters of this. Deity states in Ezekiel 38, verse 23, I will be known, yada, in the eyes of many nations. Again, in the next chapter, verse 7, we read, and my holy name will I make known in the midst of my people Israel. Neither will I suffer my holy name to be profaned anymore, and the nation shall know that I am Yahweh, the Holy One in Israel. So known, yada, occurs twice in that passage. And for the time being, one final use of the word yada, if you will. In Habakkuk chapter 2, we read, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. The word for knowledge here is the Hebrew yada. This last verse should help us to see in what sense Yahweh knew Israel at the end of Exodus 2. We would all agree that the verse in Habakkuk speaks of a future time when superstition and error will be swept away and God will be truly known and understood. Who would suggest that those in the so-called Christian society which surrounds us today really understands and knows God, the true God of Israel? Practically all of them have difficulty reconciling the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. Because they really don't understand, they really don't know Yahweh. They can't compare the God who would command Israelite to annihilate all of the pagan occupants of the land he would give them with his son who was led as a lamb to the slaughter. They just can't reconcile the two. The so-called Christian world of today is actually in darkness. In fact, as we know, the last days of Gentile darkness. Like people operating in darkness, some have certain perceptions of something greater than themselves or of a being greater than themselves. But because they are still in the dark, they cannot see him, they cannot know him as he is. At the end of Exodus 2, when we read that God knew Israel, we are to understand that he understood everything about them. He knew what their burdens were. He understood what they needed. He felt the anguish that they felt in their hearts. He understood completely the fear they had for their future. Yahweh knew them completely and absolutely. On the basis of the mighty wonders he performed and on the basis of the law and prophets, Yahweh provided Israel the opportunity to know him as well. The underlying cause for the failure of Israel and Yahweh's judgments upon the Israelites was their inability to reciprocate, to know and truly understand Yahweh as he understood and truly knew them. The history of Israel indeed is mostly that of failure, interspersed with courageous, faithful, and diligent individuals who managed to accomplish what the nation could not. In the Exodus account, we learn that the people of Israel lost faith, and with that lost faith, they lost courage before they even crossed the Red Sea. Before they crossed the Red Sea, they complained to Moses, and I quote from the scriptures, and they said unto Moses, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness." Now, if you and me were inclined to give the Israelites the benefit of the doubt, we might conclude that their minds had not had enough time to process the plagues on Egypt, ending with the Passover and their departure. But consider, then we come to the account of the events at Sinai, and we note this, and again reading from Exodus, "And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, Speak thou with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said unto the people, Fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not." The Hebrew for the word saw, as in the people saw, means to regard or perceive. So here we see some development. We see that the people perceived the wonderful and powerful manifestation of Yahweh, and it caused them to fear him. Not an unworthy attitude, for as the scriptures attest, the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. In Exodus 24, verse 3, we further read of the development of the Israelites' attitude. And Moses came and told the people all the words of Yahweh and all the judgments. And all the people answered with one voice, and said, "All the words which Yahweh have said will we do." So having sufficient evidence of the power, the faithfulness and love of Yahweh, they unanimously commit themselves to his law and will. Here then appears to be real progress. But then when we get to the 32nd chapter of Exodus, we read this concerning the Israelites, still in Sinai. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, "Up, make us gods which will go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him." And Aaron said unto them, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me." And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand, and fashioned it with a graving tool, after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, "These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt." And when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow is a feast to Yahweh." And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And Yahweh said unto Moses, "Go get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed thereunto and said, 'These be thy gods, O Israel, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt.'" And Yahweh said unto Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, and that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation." There are a lot of points worth bringing out about this passage, but we will only bring a few to your attention. Firstly, not a significant amount of time has elapsed since the Israelites had committed themselves to obey Yahweh. In fact, Yahweh's indictment of them states that they turned aside quickly out of the way. Secondly, not all of Israel was involved in this apostasy. Clearly, the tribe of Levi answered Moses' call for judgment to be executed on the perpetrators. And we read that only 3,000 were slain. So even in this time of apostasy, there was a faithful remnant. But most incredibly, and this point I want you to remember, for we will come back to this later in a fashion, the apostates proclaimed that the golden calves that they had made were the gods which brought them out of Egypt. What an incredible statement. What an incredibly delusional statement. The objects which they had just made had previously, before they were made, delivered Israel from Egypt. utter nonsense. Complete, utter nonsense. What kind of mind could rationalize that? The final point that I wish to emphasize from this account is that the phrase which states that the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play is indicative of lewd and lascivious behavior. Rose up to play can be rendered rose up to dance, and your mind can imagine the nature of the dance. In spite of all the manifestations of omnipotence and deliverance by Yahweh, the minds of these apostates were clearly corrupted by Egyptian thinking. All that we have considered so far regarding Israel has been taken from the book of Exodus. And we see, therefore, how quickly apostasy can develop. However, as we move further along in the history of Israel, we find different times and circumstances, but unfortunately with the same results. In the times of the judges, for example, we find a repeated cycle where Israel would apostatize, fall under the oppression of their neighbors because of their apostasy, be led to repentance and freedom from bondage through a judge, or we might say a savior, enjoy a short period of obedience to Yahweh's commandments, and then apostatize as a nation once again. Then during the lifetime of Samuel, the people asked for a king. This request was not made out of love and respect for Yahweh, but rather for a love of the ways of the world. We all should know, young and old, how Israel spiraled towards disaster from this point onwards. At the conclusion of Solomon's reign, and because of his backsliding, the kingdom of Israel was divided. Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, rejected the Levitical priesthood and instituted idolatry and an order of false priests. It is worthy of notion that there was never a godly or righteous king in the northern kingdom of Israel. From Jeroboam to the last king, Hoshea, they were all evil before Yahweh. It is worthy to consider the words of the scriptures concerning the ending of the northern kingdom of Israel, which provides a nice summary of Israel from Egypt until their dispersion. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Halah and in Habor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against Yahweh Elohim, which had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods, and walked in the statutes of the nations whom Yahweh cast out from before the children of Israel, and of the kings of Israel which they had made. And the children of Israel did secretly those things that were not right against Yahweh Elohim, and they built them high places in all their cities, from the tower of the watchman to the fenced city. And they set them up images and groves in every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burnt incense in all the high places, as did the nations whom Yahweh carried away before them, and wrought wicked things to provoke Yahweh to anger, for they served idols whereof Yahweh had said unto them, ye shall not do this thing. Yet Yahweh testified against Israel and against Judah by all the prophets and by all the seers, saying, turn ye from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes. according to all the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent to you by my servants the prophets. Notwithstanding, they would not hear, but hardened their necks like to the neck of their fathers that did not believe in Yahweh Elohim. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he made with their fathers and his testimonies which he testified against them. And they followed vanity and became vain and went after the nations that were round about them, concerning whom Yahweh had charged them that they should not do like them. And they left all the commandments of Yahweh Elohim and made them molten images, even to calves, and made a grove, and worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. And they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire, and used divination and enchantments, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of Yahweh to provoke him to anger. Therefore Yahweh was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only. And Judah kept not the commandments of Yahweh Elohim, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. And of course, that reading is from 2 Kings chapter 17. The kingdom of Judah did have righteous kings. But as verse 19 of the passage just read from 2 Kings indicates, the influence of Israel to the north weakened Judah to the south. As Bereans, we should take notice of the pernicious influence of Israel on Judah, and thus beware of the influence of the other divisions of Christadelphia today. In addition, the influence of the nations around weakened the resolve of both the kings and people of Judah to follow Yahweh, with the same result as that of Israel. And thus we read from the second book of Chronicles regarding Judah's downfall. Zedekiah was 1 and 20 years old when he began to reign, and reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of Yahweh Elohim, and humbled not himself before Jeremiah the prophet, speaking from the mouth of Yahweh. Moreover, all the chief of the priests and the people transgressed very much after all the abominations of the nations, and polluted the house of Yahweh, which he had hallowed in Jerusalem. And Yahweh Elohim of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of Yahweh arose against his people till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon young man or maiden, old man, or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of Yahweh, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of God and brake down the wall of Jerusalem and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. As we know, the Jews were regathered into the promised land by righteous men like Ezra and Nehemiah. But again they apostatized and ultimately filled the measure of iniquity of their fathers by crucifying the Holy One of Israel. Because of their rejection of the Son of God and of the gospel, they too were rejected and consigned to wander through the Gentile world until recent times when a number have been regathered to their ancient homestead. Yet, as we have previously stated, they still believe a variety of nonsense, of error, of superstition, of false religion, and many believing in no religion. And the overwhelming majority of them still refuse to accept that Jesus of Nazareth was their appointed Messiah. Although this history of failure is well known to most, if not all of us here assembled, what lessons can be derived to help us obtain what Yahweh desired true Israelites to be? Well, Brother Grocott thought about this matter, and Brother Grocott wrote this, and I quote, "What happened to Israel? What went wrong with their bright beginnings, their eager enthusiasm for God? And how could it have been avoided? Did they voluntarily and consciously choose the path of self-destruction? Or did it overtake them without warning from behind as the accumulated consequence of deeper and deeper self-deception and neglect? To the very last moment, they did not see the blow falling. Each increasingly ominous portent of disaster found them further blinded by the perverted fleshly exhilaration of a still lower descent into abomination and rebellion against God. If they could have seen to the end the consequences of their course, if they had fully realized what was in store, if they could have clearly perceived things in their true light, would they have acted differently before it was too late? Unquestionably, unless they were entirely devoid of reason. So in the final analysis, the whole trouble lay in their perception. True, what led them astray were the natural motions of their flesh, but everyone has them. A man is not helpless. A man is not a helpless slave to his flesh in any respect, unless he chooses to be. There is always available an inexhaustible supply of divine power if man will only accept it to help fight himself. But sometimes we are not very anxious to get rid of our idols, and after a few half-hearted attempts, as a concession to our conscience, we find it easy to convince ourselves that it cannot be done." End of quote. So as Brother Grocott points out, they did not intend to apostatize. They didn't think to themselves, "Well, it's a nice day, let's apostatize." They just did. What do the scriptures say about the matter? In Isaiah chapter 5, we read, "They regard not the work of Yahweh, neither consider the operation of his hands. Therefore, my people are gone into captivity because they have no knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst." The word knowledge here is not yada, but rather daith, but it has the same relationship to being unaware. The Spirit through Jeremiah stated concerning man when warning Judah to be not like the Gentiles, "Every man is brutish in his knowledge. Every founder is confounded by the graven image, for his molten image is falsehood, and there is no breath in them." Again, the word for knowledge is daith. And the verse addresses the fact that the Gentiles of the world are not cognizant or aware of the existence and claims of the God of Israel. But most directly to the point concerning the failure of the Israelites is the passage found in Hosea chapter 4, where we'll read the first 6 verses. "Hear the word of Yahweh, ye children of Israel, for Yahweh hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying and killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break out, and blood toucheth blood. Therefore shall the land mourn, and everyone that dwelleth therein shall languish, with the beast of the field and with the fowls of heaven, yea, the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. Yet let no man strive nor reprove another, for thy people are as they that strive with the priest. Therefore shalt thou fall in the day, and the prophet also shall fall with thee in the night, and I will destroy thy mother. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee, that thou shalt be no priest to me, seeing thou hast forgotten the law of thy God. I will also forget thy children. Twice in this passage, the Israelites' lack of knowledge is addressed. The reader will note that this lack of knowledge was due to choice on their part, for the scriptures testify that they rejected knowledge. It may seem strange that the people to whom had been committed the oracles of God, for whom God had performed numerous wonders, and for whom God had delivered from the hands of their enemies on several occasions, would lack knowledge or reject knowledge. We should consider the analysis again of Brother Grocott on this matter. Brother Grocott reminds us that sin is ignorance. He said, and I quote, "Transgression is just ignorance, trying to battle the inevitable, taking issue with the omnipotence of God, a persistent delusion that we are different from everyone else, and that somehow we will escape the consequences of our folly. Sin is obstinate and childish refusal to face the facts. God is the central fact of the universe. God's will, His power, His purpose. These are the basic facts which dominate eternity. They are inescapable. Sin consists in acting in a way that ignores these facts. Sin, therefore, is ignorance, often willful, intentional ignorance. Peter says of the ungodly, 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5, for this they are willingly ignorant of. To transgress divine law, we must either not know or else not give full weight to all the facts of the case." End of quote. I would add to Brother Grocott's analysis that the knowledge required, which the Israelites rejected, was not an academic understanding of various facts, but rather an understanding of who God is, what He required of them, the basis of His protection and care for them, and so forth. A knowledge that is like unto that that is developed in the minds of children regarding their parents and the relationship between them. Yahweh would have had Israel to know Him just as He knew them and their bondage in Egypt, as we read at the end of Exodus chapter 2. The scary thing about Israel's rejection of knowledge is that it led them to a state where God left them to their own imaginations. In other words, when they chose to live according to what they thought was right, according to what pleased them, Yahweh allowed their thinking to go unchecked, which resulted in them ultimately believing and promulgating every foolish and ungodly notion under the sun. The process that Paul addresses in Romans chapter 1 happened to Israel. So from Romans 1, verses 18 through 28, we read, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them. For God hath showed it unto them, for the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and to four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who changed the truth of God into a lie, and worship and serve the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this cause God gave them up into vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature, and likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman burned in their lust one toward another, men with men working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was made meet. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient. In writing about the Israelites' descent from a state of knowledge to a state of reprobate thinking, Brother Grocott offered this, quote, "They would have preferred perhaps just to go partway. The depths to which they ultimately descended would have appalled them at first. But there was no partway. God did not allow it. When once they had chosen forbidden fruit, God saw to it that they had their fill." Some of us gathered here this morning may reason that what happened to Israel can happen to us. Surely we will not choose idols over the truth. Surely we will not reject Yahweh for the things of this world. But the recorded history of Israel shows that it can happen to us. When those gathered at Sinai assented that they would do all that Yahweh had commanded, surely they didn't contemplate failure. Yet bit by bit they slid from the knowledge of Yahweh and as a nation failed. And the Apostle Paul well warned the Gentile ecclesia being grafted into the Israelitish tree to not boast. For as we know, the Gentile ecclesia is a pattern similar to Israel, and a pattern similar to Israel also descended into a state where knowledge of God was rejected, and with the same result. We read of the prophecy of the development of the apostasy in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. For the mystery of iniquity doth already work, only he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. And then shall that wicked be revealed whom the Lord shall consume with the spirit of his mouth and shall destroy with the brightness of his coming. Even him whose coming is after the working of Satan with all power and signs and lying wonders and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish because they receive not the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie, that they all might be condemned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. God turned those who rejected the knowledge of God and truth over to reprobate minds as well, with the result that then and today, they choose to believe a strong delusion. That is to say, they believe in superstitions, ghosts, spirits, wizards, a supernatural devil, and all kinds of other utter nonsense. It is extremely unfortunate that the historic examples of the nation of Israel and the apostolic ecclesia is not sufficient to thwart the same decline in the Christadelphians. Again, in speaking of the Christadelphians, we are, of course, speaking of the broader community, for I firmly believe that the Berean community is presently sound from doctrinal error. But as has already been suggested this weekend, we have no cause for boasting, for the scriptures and history have shown that it is possible for all to fall. So what can we do to prevent from rejecting knowledge and being destroyed for lack of knowledge? We have considered briefly the pattern of failure. What can we do to succeed? We will offer our own suggestions as well as some comments offered by Brother Grocott. Firstly, we should all develop a familiarity and correct understanding of the scriptures. In order to obey, one must know and understand what is required. In Romans 10, Paul stated about his own people, "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved, for I bear them record that they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God." In the very same chapter, he offered this: "So then faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God." There is no substitute for scriptural knowledge. Brother Grocott, emphasizing the importance of the scriptures, wrote, "Sin is lack of knowledge, natural darkness and ignorance, the blind groping of the thinking of the flesh. The remedy is knowledge, divine knowledge, constantly increased by study. A gradual building up of enlightenment and education, line upon line, precept upon precept, gradually displacing the shifting chaos of ignorance and undisciplined natural feeling with a solid framework of knowledge and clear perception of eternal fact." The textbook is the scriptures. It has often been said by prominent men that a knowledge of the scriptures is better than a college education. That is, even from a natural and worldly point of view and for natural ends. It gives a fuller and more rounded view of life and background of experience. But its real purpose is to prepare us, not for the preeminence and the life that now is, but for that which is to come. To school us in the knowledge of God, to give us a proportioned groundwork for balanced and constructive self-development. Secondly, we must have a genuine love and appreciation for the blessings and care of Yahweh. Upon contemplation, a person with an honest heart will reciprocate the love and care extended to him or her by others. How much more so is this reciprocation appropriate to the one in whom we live, move, and have our very being? Israel as a nation failed to develop or to sustain this appreciation. Thirdly, we should all have a recognition of our dependence on Yahweh, and upon recognizing this and accepting it, we should not attempt to resolve the great issues of life by relying on our own cleverness. We should comprehend that we can only bear the trials and tribulations that must be endured for our own preparation for the kingdom with God's help. A true realization and acceptance of our dependence on Him fosters a childlike acceptance of His claims upon us. Fourth, we should be better prepared to maintain and develop our knowledge of Yahweh by properly understanding and adhering to the principle of separation. The nation of Israel wrongly thought that they could mimic the nations around them and maintain their relationship with Yahweh. They were wrong. They disobeyed His commandment to destroy all the inhabitants of Canaan, with the result that Canaanitish thinking polluted their thinking. They were counseled, "Be ye holy, for I am holy," but they allowed the principle of separation from the world to be breached, and with fatal results. Unfortunately, too many Christadelphians today feel that they can play with the fire of the world and not get burned. Fifth, we should appreciate the high calling to which we have been called, but not expect that God will be more lenient or treat us differently than those who have gone before. Brother Grocott articulated this attitude very well when he wrote about what the scriptures are able to teach us. Again, I quote from Brother Grocott: "We learn, and sometimes it seems that this is more important than anything else, that there is nothing particularly unique about ourselves, our lives, our problems. An endless procession of humanity has preceded us. Every phase and shade of human experience and emotion has come and gone and come again, time without number. We are no different. We are no exception. The rules of life and death were written long before we came. Every situation that confronts us is a well-tried path in which, of those who have passed, a few have succeeded by accepting divine guidance, and the rest have failed. And now it is our part. The rules will not be changed on our account. We must write a record to put beside the rest. Life is complex, but the rules of life are simple. Fear God and keep His commandments. Not asking for special favors and consideration just because it happens to be us, but asking instead for the wisdom and strength and courage to take our place with the rest and fill our part as it comes to us. Sixth, knowing that it is easy to fall from grace, we must always be alert and watch for the danger signs of backsliding in ourselves and in our loved ones. On this matter, Brother Grocott wrote in connection with the decline of Israel, and I quote again, "The great consuming pity was that the knowledge had been there, but it had slipped through their fingers. Gradually, they forgot all about it. Once or twice, they ran across it by accident, as in the days of Josiah, and there was a great scurry of self-searching for a while. But it soon slipped away again, and the old self-satisfied slumber returned." How strenuously Paul labored against this deadly tendency to relax and fall asleep. His constant keynote is watch and remember. You, brothers and sisters and young people, may be overwhelmed at this point, and I recognize this is a little bit long, by all of these suggestions that we've put forth. Surely they are effective safeguards against repeating the failure of Israel as well as that of the apostolic ecclesia. And surely more could be offered. But if we were required to summarize all of these points into one, we could do no better than to cite the words of the Master. Be reading from Matthew 22, Jesus said unto him, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. All the commandments of God are comprehended in this great commandment. If we do this, brothers and sisters and young people, we shall never fail." Thank you.